Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young. Coming up, Deputy Secretary rather of Defense Paul Wolfowitz is asked to defend the president's request for $87 billion for Iraq.
In Iraq, some Army reservists find out they won't be home for Christmas after all.
And have you given at the office? It's one of the reasons big money isn't out of politics.
Consider yourself in a large company. Your boss comes walking over, your supervisor, and says, gee, I'm helping out a candidate for president, John Doe. I'd really like you to contribute.
The EPA, one of the agency's own, tells us how New Yorkers didn't get the whole story on post-9/11 air quality.
These stories and a conversation with filmmaker Sofia Coppola coming up Here and Now.
The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Carol Van Dam. There's been an explosion outside an army base in Israel. Authorities say there are at least 30 casualties, 15 of them hospitalized. Preliminary reports say three people have been killed. From Jerusalem, NPR's Julie McCarthy reports.
The explosion was reported at a bus stop at the Thrifin Army Base, a 15-minute drive from Tel Aviv. Army radio reports 15 people have been rushed to an emergency room. The scene of the explosion is only yards from a large civilian hospital. A spokesman for the ambulance service called the blast a severe terrorist attack. Israel's Channel 1 said the body of the suspected suicide bomber was found near the scene. Israel has been bracing for an attack following its failed assassination attempt in Gaza over the weekend on the spiritual leader of Hamas, Sheikh Yassin. The country since has been in a state of high alert, which police say was elevated to its highest level today. Televised reports say this afternoon a hitchhiking station was packed with soldiers leaving the camp at day's end when a bomber walked up to them and blew himself up. Julie McCarthy, NPR News, Jerusalem.
Thousands of National Guard and Army Reserve forces are in for a longer stay in Iraq. The Army is extending their tours of duty in Iraq to a full year, longer than many troops had anticipated. NPR's Ivan Watson in Baghdad has spoken to many soldiers stationed around the Iraqi capital.
There are two main stresses for the American soldiers here. Number one is the threat of attack of rocket-propelled grenade ambushes and explosive devices. The second is the long separation from their families. Some soldiers are dealing with divorces over satellite phones. Others are not allowed to see newborn children for periods as long as a year. And one soldier I actually heard about who was here for a year, his spouse is set to come here after he leaves, basically, for another year. So we're talking about a 2-year separation for him and his wife.
NPR's Ivan Watson in Baghdad. Top Pentagon officials are being grilled about the $87 billion President Bush has requested to pay for the fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan, as well as the rebuilding of Iraq. Defense Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz told a Senate panel that the U.S. does not start a job it is not prepared to finish.
The costs are large. But it is a battle that we can win, and it is a battle that we must win. Because victory in this battle will be a major victory in the war on terrorism, and a major defeat for the global terrorist networks.
The $87 billion is in addition to the $79 billion Congress has already approved. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 20 points to 95.66 in moderate trading of 595 million shares. The Nasdaq Composite is down 5 points to 1833.25. You're listening to NPR News. In NPR's business update, the parent company of United Airlines plans to launch a low-cost carrier in the first quarter of next year. Lisa Labez reports from Chicago.
UAL Corporation says the new airline will initially use 40 planes. United filed for bankruptcy in December. The company says now that it has wage and other cost cuts in place, it can turn its attention to the new airline, so far known by its code name, Starfish. CEO Glenn Tilton says the company is starting to work out a permanent name and a marketing strategy. Low-cost airlines, including Southwest and JetBlue, have steadily been taking market share away from United and other major carriers. Delta recently started its own low-cost carrier called Song. It flies between New York and Florida. Corporate travel managers who are part of the Business Travel Coalition say United just doesn't have the luxury of time or the resources to launch a new business. For NPR News, I'm Lisa Labus in Chicago.
Shares of Research in Motion are up more than 20% in early trading on Wall Street today. The maker of BlackBerry handheld units has raised its profit estimate for the fiscal second quarter. BlackBerry says it now expects revenue for the second quarter ending August 30th to come in between $123 million to $126 million. It had previously estimated revenue to be in the neighborhood of $105 to $115 million. A former trader with Knight Trading Group has acknowledged he stole $1.4 million from the company. Brian Delaney pleaded guilty to two felony charges and has agreed to cooperate with investigators. Delaney was involved in a scheme that locked in profits for him and his co-conspirators at the company's expense. Knight Trading is a top market maker in NASDAQ stocks. I'm Carol Van Dam, NPR News in Washington.
The NPR Shop introduces All Songs Considered 3. The newest compilation of music heard on All Things Considered at NPR.org.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz faced tough questions on Capitol Hill today about the mushrooming cost of rebuilding and occupying Iraq. Senator Carl Levin, Democrat of Michigan, had this to say.
And Mr. Wolfowitz, you told Congress in March that, quote, we are dealing with a country that can really finance its own reconstruction and relatively soon, close quote. Talk about rosy scenarios.
Joining us on the line from Capitol is Andrea Stone, congressional reporter for USA Today. Andrea sat in on today's Senate Armed Services Committee hearings. Andrea, what's the mood of the hearings? What's the feeling there?
I think that Secretary Wolfowitz, who's on the same panel with the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, the General Dick Myers, are pretty much on the defensive this morning. And especially from the Democratic side, although Senator McCain from Arizona had some very sharp questioning for the two of them. And they're still in there right now.
Well, we heard Carl Levin just pointing out that Paul Wolfowitz told Congress back in March, as he said, that oil revenues would pretty much pay for reconstruction. Did Mr. Wolfowitz respond today about the lack of those oil revenues?
I think he didn't really respond directly to that. There was a lot of questioning about how much is this going to cost. I mean, the $87 billion that the president asked for is just for next year. Senator Kennedy wanted to know, how many years are we talking about here? What is the total cost of occupation and reconstruction? A lot of unanswered questions.
And we know that administration officials today are saying that those oil revenues in particular are going to be far less than they predicted back in March. Well, Carl Levin also pointed out that when Pentagon officials predicted before the war that the effort would cost between $100 and $200 billion, they were ridiculed.
Right. I think there's a definite difference of opinion. I mean, back when the General Eric Shinseki was the chief of staff of the Army, he talked about hundreds of thousands of troops being needed, and Mr. Wolfowitz said that was ridiculous, or some words to that effect, and now it's all coming back to haunt them because it looks like there will be a much greater need for what's in Iraq right now, if not in American troops than in international troops.
Yeah. Speaking of troops, what did Mr. Wolfowitz say about the need for troops?
The administration is insisting we don't need a single more American troops there, but we do need other countries' help. They want to make a big deal that there are 29 countries providing 23,000 troops as of today, but the vast majority of those are from the United Kingdom and from Australia, with very small contingents from other countries. And the countries that the administration would really like to get on board, Turkey, Pakistan, India, the countries that have a large Muslim population, have been balking. They don't want to go in and send their troops until there is a U.N. mandate. And, of course, that was another bone of contention, is why did it take the administration so long to go to the U.N.?
Mr. Wolfowitz, one of the architects of the war, also a proponent of taking Saddam Hussein out of power long before the U.S. War with Iraq. Are you surprised that the hearing so far has been as civil as it has been?
You know, actually, I am. They're, like I said, they're still in there questioning. But it has been very civil. I thought Levin was very even-handed, and I thought Senator McCain was probably more harsh. Senator Kennedy, just before he came out, was really lashing into Mr. Wolfowitz about, you know, that apparently the administration knew that there were going to be dangers, and then they knew that this was going to be harder than they let the American people think it was. And so he had some very sharp words. Mm.
Well, it's not over yet. Andrea, thank you.
Okay.
Andrea Stone, congressional correspondent for USA Today and a frequent guest on Here and Now. She spoke to us from the Capitol.
Well, the number of troops in Iraq, one subject at Senate hearings this morning, as we just heard. But the Bush administration does seem to have one new solution to bolster the number of troops in and around Iraq. The Army has ordered thousands of National Guard and Reserve troops to extend their tours of duty. The new order requires a 12-month tour on the ground in Iraq and surrounding countries, while previous year-long mobilizations included time for pre-deployment training and post-deployment briefing time, which was usually in the U.S. Here's General Richard Meyer discussing the change at the Senate Foreign Relations Committee today.
And as long as we have active duty Army engaged as we do around the world, then the reserves are going to have to play a role. It's a fact of life that we need the combat service support that these reserve components provide.
Joining us to discuss what this will mean for men and women serving in the reserves and National Guard is Joyce Razor from the National Military Family Association. Welcome, Joyce.
Thank you.
Joyce, now there are some 129,000 Army Guard and Reserve members mobilized overseas. What's the new order going to mean for them?
It's going to mean that they're going to come a lot closer to spending the entire 2 years for which they were mobilized actually on active duty. Most of the orders written after 9/11 were for up to 2 years. A lot of folks thought, as you said in your introduction, that it would be shorter time in theater and maybe just about a year total on active duty. Folks who were among the first to go after the first of this year probably expected to be home for Christmas. Now it sounds like they're not going to be. And a lot of it also depends on their specialty. There are certain specialties that reside almost completely within the Guard and Reserve components. Very high demand, civil affairs, and a lot of the security forces that are being activated are Guard and Reserve folks. If their specialty is in demand, they should look for a longer period of time.
But when you sign up for the National Guard or the Reserves, you sign up to serve at the pleasure of the Commander-in-Chief, right?
That's right.
Why would members of the Guard and Reserve be upset about this, if they are?
This length of deployment is unprecedented. And so for a lot of folks who were looking at history and past experience, we're into brand new territory right now.
Now, of course, most of these men and women have jobs outside the military. Remind us what the laws are about keeping a job when you're in the National Guard or Reserves and you're away from your job for an extended period of time.
The law protects their job. They are entitled to come back to their job or a comparable job in the company. Now, what happens for a long deployment, however, is that there's a greater chance that their employer may undergo layoffs, a restructuring, many things that can affect whether or not there's a job to come back to. Folks who own small businesses, however, don't have that same level of protection in law. They're the ones who are really scrambling.
How might this affect recruitment, and is there any indication that it's already affecting recruitment for the Guard and Reserves?
We're not hearing of any negative effect yet. What we're starting to hear a few rumblings about are from the folks who are getting out of the active force. Normally, this is a very good recruiting pool for the Guard and Reserve. Mm-hmm. The folks getting out of the active force are looking at the deployment levels of the Guard and Reserve saying, if I want to keep deploying, I'm just going to stay on active duty. So they're not joining the Guard and Reserve in the numbers that they used to.
Joyce, have you heard anyone from where you sit, from within the Guard and Reserves, or any family member saying simply, we were tricked?
No, I'm not. I'm not hearing we were tricked. I'm hearing wish we'd have known a little more information so we could plan better.
Joyce Razor, thanks very much for joining us.
Sure.
Joyce Razor from the National Military Family Association joined us from Alexandria, Virginia.
Back in June, Kevin Albert of New York City, a Merrill Lynch employee, gave $2,000 to the Bush-Cheney reelection campaign, the maximum an individual is allowed to donate to a candidate under new campaign finance rules. Kevin wasn't alone. Many of his co-workers did the same thing, and Merrill Lynch collected the checks, more than $280,000 worth. Well, Merrill Lynch isn't alone in collecting that kind of big money, and President Bush isn't the only candidate receiving it. But campaign finance rules, now under review at the U.S. Supreme Court, ban large donations from corporations. So how was Merrill Lynch able to do this? The answer, bundling. Here to explain bundling is Kent Cooper. He's the co-founder of PoliticalMoneyline.com, a website which tracks money and politics. And Kent, what exactly is bundling?
Well, bundling is a method by which an individual, possibly at a large company or organization, goes around to individual employees and asks them to make out a check directly to a candidate. And the person would sit down and write a check out to John Doe for president, John Doe for Congress, and then would hand the check over to that solicitor or collector. And that person might collect hundreds of checks, bundle them together literally in an envelope, and send it off to the campaign saying, here's what I did, and here are all these checks for your campaign.
Is it legal?
It's legal. The caution that they have to watch out for is when they're a supervisor or the head of a company, they can't bring pressure on the person and threaten them with loss of employment. They've got to ask for a voluntary contribution.
Well, that's a pretty sticky territory, isn't it? Because wouldn't some employees feel pressured to do it?
Oh, certainly. And that's the fear that people have. I mean, consider yourself in a large company. Your boss comes walking over, your supervisor, and says, gee, I'm helping out a candidate for president, John Doe. I'd really like you to contribute. Mm-hmm. Well, it's that sort of subtle threat that sometimes gets close to coercion.
Well, let's make it clear that this is hard money. These are direct donations to individuals as opposed to soft money, contributions to political parties. That money has been limited, and that's what's being considered by the Supreme Court this week. Whereas hard money, individual donations, that's traditionally Republican source. But why is President Bush said to have taken this to high art?
Well, you're utilizing a higher contribution limit. It increased from $1,000 to $2,000. And you're dealing with executives or company employees who have the time to go around and solicit from individuals in the company. And sometimes that person who delivers the checks in a bundle feels that they get a might get a reward or that maybe they will be have their phone call answered when they call the candidate at a later date when they're in office.
But Howard Dean, a Democratic candidate, has also taken a page from President Bush.
Well, he's taken it to a much wider, broader scope in using the Internet for more fundraising, where rather than going through an employer, a wealthy individual who might have a lot of employees, he's gone broader to a wider base of people in general solicitations over the Internet. There aren't a lot of people who wake up in the morning and decide they're going to give, whether you're an employee or just the average citizen. Usually you're responding to some request, but there are not many of them in the country. You're talking about less than 1% of the population ever gives a political contribution. Once you've reached your limit, however, you can't give beyond that $2,000. So in many cases, those people are then asked to go out and get contributions from others.
And that's how bundling sort of, you know, you tell a friend and you tell a friend and you tell a friend.
Correct. And these candidates need to get as many people as possible to be solicitors.
Well, Ken Cooper, thank you.
You're welcome.
Ken Cooper is co-founder of PoliticalMoneyline.com, speaking to us about bundling.
Just ahead, what did the EPA know and why didn't they say it? We'll talk with an EPA scientist about air quality in New York after 9/11.
And later in the program, filmmaker Sofia Coppola about her new film, Lost in Translation.
There's more coming up here and now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Senator Hillary Clinton has threatened to block the nomination of Michael Levitt, the governor of Utah, as head of the Environmental Protection Agency until concerns about the air quality around the collapsed World Trade Center are answered. Last month, the Inspector General of the EPA released a report critical of the agency's press releases following the disaster. The report said the White House instructed the agency to say that the air around the ground was safe to breathe. Well, for more about the report, we spoke to Kate Jenkins, who's an environmental scientist with the EPA. She made it clear that she's not speaking as an official voice for the agency. She has been working as a volunteer advocate for the citizens around Ground Zero for the past 2 years.
The warnings about the hazards were very much diluted, or important information was deleted by the White House. But that could have been all right if the White House had not deleted the most important thing, namely that EPA wanted to recommend professional cleaning for all of these apartments and businesses. And that, as a result, citizens were literally going into these places with shovels, brooms, mops, not wearing even paper dust masks.
And what's your concern that they may have come in contact with?
There is a host of hazardous substances in World Trade Center dust. We call it WTC dust. Asbestos, that is probably the largest volume, the major concern. There is silica. Silica is also a known human carcinogen. Mercury, lead, dioxins, polychlorinated biphenyls, all of these products of combustion from the fire, it's in the dust, and if you are exposed to it for very large quantities over short periods or for the duration, EPA has not insisted and required uniform cleanups of residences and businesses anywhere. The cleanup program by EPA so far has been voluntary. That's highly inadequate.
Well, we should say that the EPA acting administrator says that the news releases were not a result of pressure from the White House, but the EPA Inspector General's report, as you pointed out, is pretty damning. And it also says in it that a definitive answer to whether the air was safe to breathe may not be settled for years to come.
That is when we will see some of the victims. I think that we already have, as the Inspector General said, anecdotal reports of people with chronic bronchitis. So that is a condition that has cropped up early. I believe, as a scientist, we have more certainty that the air was unsafe. We know that explosions and fires in buildings release hazardous amounts of asbestos. So even if we did not have at EPA the data to prove absolutely and conclusively that there was a hazard in those early days, we know from past experience that it has always caused a hazard in the past.
On a personal level, it must be pretty frustrating to be a scientist for the EPA and not be able to get that word out in the aftermath of 9/11. In other words, the word that came out was the news release.
Yes, but there were many first responders for public warning, so to speak, in those early months. The Inspector General's report notes that a poll showed that 70% of the people at the time in those early months did not trust EPA's statements about safety. There were people speaking out very strongly. Not everybody took the right precautions, but because people in those early months were brave enough to speak out, at least some of the harmful exposures were lessened.
Are you concerned about your job?
No. I've been doing this for 2 years. I'm honest. You know, people here at EPA, we have 18,000 employees, and there's a great diversity of opinions on what EPA should be doing in the aftermath of the World Trade Center. I know of several individuals who have been threatened with being fired for even something like supplying me with documents that aren't even confidential. So there has always been that problem. My supervisors are aware of my activities. I have been sticking to the science and reviewing what EPA does, and if they make errors, I call them on it.
Where in your mind does the EPA go from here, especially as it regards the center, Ground Zero?
Well, I hope they will follow the recommendations of the Inspector General report. Retest the buildings, reclean these buildings as whole buildings, both residential and commercial spaces. Retest the perimeter, hopefully this time using the correct analytical methods that will show whether asbestos really is there. There will still be a struggle to get them to do more and to do it. It is a money question, and it's a time thing. And while the cleanup of New York City is in progress over the next few years or whatever, it is going to hurt the economy. So there's going to be the other move to get moves to get it over with already, you know, that type of thing. But I, the citizens who have been trying to be advocates for a better cleanup, are so grateful to the EPA Inspector Nikki Tinsley, because it is giving it the public attention that it needs now. And it's, I mean, these are the living victims. We spent so much money on recovering remains, which is so good and so comforting for the family and the loved ones of those who actually died. But all of these other people have been neglected, not only in a cleanup, but also in recognition.
Kate Jenkins, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Kate Jenkins, environmental specialist with the Environmental Protection Agency.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, September 11th, Chileans mark the 30th anniversary of the coup that ended the rule of Salvador Allende.
And our resident foodies share their expertise on packing a healthy school lunchbox. That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at MathWorks.com.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, own any mutual funds? The latest financial shenanigans give privileged customers an unfair advantage over the ordinary Joe.
We don't really know how common it is. Estimates have put it at up to $5 billion a year of trading, which is certainly a big loss to the average investor.
And director Sofia Coppola rides a tsunami of praise with her new film, Lost in Translation.
Well, I wanted to have a kind of romantic friendship, something that's not a relationship and not just a friendship, those kind of ones in between.
These stories coming up here and now.
I'm Steve Brown. There's more violence in the Middle East. An explosion went off at a bus stop near an army base in central Israel. At least three people were killed and dozens more were wounded. Security sources say the attack apparently was carried out by a suicide bomber. Israel quickly pinned the blame on the Palestinian Authority. 2 days after President Bush addressed the nation asking for $87 billion to fight terrorism in Iraq, Democratic senators are blasting the administration for miscalculating the cost of going to war. At a Senate Armed Services Committee hearing, Democrats noted the White House rejected earlier estimates of up to $200 billion, which now appear to be close to the mark. Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz says the money is critical for the fight against terrorism.
The costs are large, but it is a battle that we can win, and it is a battle that we must win. Because victory in this battle will be a major victory in the war on terrorism, and a major defeat for the global terrorist networks.
Meanwhile, National Guard units are reportedly having their tours of duty extended in Iraq and surrounding countries. More suspected cases of malaria are reported among American troops. Military officials say 10 more Marines and sailors who were in Liberia last month are in the hospital with symptoms of the disease. That brings to 43 the number of troops who took part in the mission who are showing symptoms. Malaria has been confirmed in 12 of those cases. Testing continues on the other 31. The government is reportedly prepared to color-code air travelers. The new system will be phased in next year. It measures the risks posed by travelers who board flights in the U.S. Passengers will be given one of three codes based on part of their travel plans, traveling companions, and the date the ticket was purchased. Codes range from green to red. If coded red, travelers face police questioning and will be barred from boarding the aircraft. Critics say the new system is too intrusive. The $20 bill is getting a new look, as the toughest American currency to counterfeit is about to get tougher. A new colorized $20 bills with splashes of peach, blue, and yellow will start surfacing at banks and cash machines next month. Officials say the colors will make them harder to copy. On Wall Street, stocks are lower. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 29 points at 95.58. NASDAQ is down 3 points at 18.85. The S&P 500 is up 5 points at 10.27. It's 33 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Here and Now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Elliot Spitzer is at it again. After successfully pursuing corrupt Wall Street banks, the high-profile Attorney General of New York now has a new target, the $7 trillion mutual fund industry. Millions of Americans put their money into mutual funds, either directly or through pension plans, but they do it on the assumption that all investors are treated equally. But Elliot Spitzer says he's uncovered two illegal trading schemes that let privileged big players cheat the market. The schemes are called late trading and market timing. Two mutual fund companies, Bank of America and Janus, yesterday agreed to reimburse ordinary investors who were hurt by the scams. And Canary Capital Investments, a hedge fund company that benefited from the scam, has already returned $30 million and paid a $10 million penalty. But this may be only the tip of the iceberg. To explain more, we're joined now by Deborah Brewster, editor of Global Investing at the Financial Times newspaper. And welcome, Deborah.
Thank you.
Well, Deborah, how does late trading work?
It's clearly illegal, and how it works is this. Unlike shares, which are traded at different prices throughout the day, mutual funds are priced only once a day at 4 o'clock, and they basically add up the total value of the stocks in the fund and strike a price at 4 o'clock. And so what that means is anybody who buys or sells the shares is supposed to get the same price on that day. But late trading allowed people to buy after 4 o'clock, which is illegal, and how it could benefit them is, for example, if you knew that the fund had like 10% of their assets in Walmart, at 5 o'clock, say Walmart announced that its profits were doing much better than anyone expected or thought, you could reasonably expect that Walmart shares the next day are going to open substantially up. And in other words, the fund the next day was going to open substantially higher. What late trading did was allow a fund to buy at 5 o'clock, in other words, at the cheaper price, and they could sell them the next day at the higher price that the fund had.
And the average guy or gal didn't get access to this.
Exactly. That is actually illegal.
What about the other scheme, market timing, which is...
Yes, the other scheme is not actually illegal, and in fact, it's kind of a more interesting area because we have up to 100 hedge funds that are actually engaged in this, and it operates in pretty much the same way based on the 4 o'clock timing. Say you knew the fund had 10% of its assets in Toyota, which is a Japan-traded company. When they add up the value of the fund at 4 o'clock, Japan has already been closed for 2 hours. It closed at 2 o'clock New York time. But say at 3 o'clock, the U.S. consumer confidence figures came out showing that U.S. consumers were extremely confident, were like to increase their consumption of everything, including presumably Toyota cars. You might reasonably expect and would know that the next day Toyota shares are going to go up. In other words, you know at, even at 3 o'clock, as soon as the consumer confidence figures come out, that that fund is actually worth more than the level that it's valued at, because in fact it's got late information about Toyota in it. And that is not illegal, and a lot of people might say, well, you're just clever to kind of work all that out. But the idea is that mutual funds are for long-term investors, and mutual funds say in their prospectuses that they actively discourage this kind of jumping in and out of a fund based on these kinds of calculations.
Deborah, how common is late trading and market timing?
Late trading is not very common because, as I said, it is clearly illegal, and what Elliot Spitzer has uncovered is probably a relatively small number of funds that allow it. Market timing is much more common because it is not illegal. It's simply a hypocrisy that he has uncovered, that the funds say they discourage it and don't. We don't really know how common it is. Estimates have put it at up to $5 billion a year of trading, which is certainly a big loss to the average investors.
Canary Capital Funds recently paid $40 million in penalties for this sort of thing. We alluded in our introduction to the Bank of America and Janus planning to reimburse investors if it can be shown that investors were disadvantaged by this. Tip of the iceberg?
I think it probably is the tip of the iceberg because I think Mr. Spitzer has very cleverly held his fire on the mutual funds, and he's basically standing there and saying, well, what are you going to offer us?
Now, why would mutual fund companies allow this to happen, Deborah? There must have been some benefit to them to allow big-time high rollers to do this sort of thing. What do they get?
They got a cut of the profits in some cases. The ones that have been fingered, actually, I think one of them got a 6% cut of the trading profits. Basically, it was a quid pro quo where the hedge funds concerned struck a deal with them to invest a certain amount in the funds in exchange for being allowed to trade a certain quantity of the funds every day.
Well, Deborah, just to finish up, Elliot Spitzer is a high-profile figure in New York. A lot of talk about his possibly running for governor. But why is he driving all this and not the SEC, which is really charged with overseeing the financial market?
That's a question a lot of people are asking, and the SEC has been holding long-standing inquiries into both hedge funds and mutual funds. The answer is really the same reason that he spearheaded the Wall Street bank settlement. He simply cleverly identified a single recurrent practice, which is highly dubious, got people to kind of sing effectively about it, and then has stood there and threatened to finger everybody else unless they come forward and strike a deal. It's a very clever and very effective strategy.
Mm-hmm. Deborah Brewster, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Deborah Brewster is an editor at the Financial Times newspaper. She spoke to us from New York.
The wonderful, horrible life of Leni Riefenstahl has ended. The filmmaker who brought Hitler's image to the masses in her propaganda films, Triumph of the Will and Olympia, died Monday night at the age of 101. At the age of 91, she was herself the subject of a documentary called The Wonderful, Horrible Life of Leni Riefenstahl. At the time, she was the world's oldest active scuba diver, and the film details her famous camera shots, her adventuresome spirit. But it also shows her unrepentant about her role in creating a monster. Throughout her adult life, Riefenstahl claimed she knew nothing about Nazi events being staged for her camera, about the genocide against Jews. In a 1965 interview, Riefenstahl said when Triumph of the Will was made, it was not a propaganda film. She said she just captured events as they were happening with her camera.
A commentator is an enemy of the film art. Enemy. Film art is moving and picture. And you must be strong enough through moving, rhythmus, and the picture and the sound of the real atmosphere to give the impression what you want to show, but not to explain. Then I can have a theater or something to speak. Yes, it is not film.
Leni Riefenstahl died in her home in Bavaria. She takes with her to the grave the answer we will never know. She was the director, one of the greatest of all time. She called the shots. How could she not have known?
Still to come, she's a young filmmaker with a hot new film, and she's the daughter of Hollywood royalty. We'll talk with Sofia Coppola. You're listening to Here and Now. You lie in bed at night. You'd like to sleep, but your legs are keeping you awake. They feel creepy crawly somehow, and they kick every few seconds, all night, for years, and you're exhausted. You've got restless legs. It's a little-known syndrome, but it affects some 20 million Americans. Judy Foreman is here and Now's regular health columnist, and she's here to tell us more about this. And Judy, welcome.
Thank you.
It's a new one to me, Judy. In your column this week, you recount the case of a patient who goes to a doctor, a neurologist, with symptoms like those we just described. And tell us what happened.
Yeah, this is actually a true story told to me by a neurologist. And the guy goes to the doctor and says, you know, doc, I got these creepy, crawly legs. I can't sleep. I get up. I do a few knee bends. That makes it better. Go back to bed and it's worse again. And he says, what have I got? And the doctor says, I don't know, but I've got it too.
The neurologist didn't know what
yeah,
it was,
I mean,
either.
It's a very under-recognized syndrome, but it apparently affects 20 million Americans and makes their lives miserable.
RLS, restless leg syndrome. How does it affect the people who suffer from it?
Well, it basically impedes their sleep. It's a worse has a worse effect on sleep than almost anything else. It's not insomnia per se. It's just that your body is twitching all night, essentially. It seems to be caused basically by iron deficiency, but in your brain, not your blood.
So what do you do?
You can get blood tests and find out if your iron is normal or not. And if it's low, you can talk to your doctor about taking iron pills, which may help because having adequate levels of iron in your brain helps your brain produce this substance called dopamine, which is a neurotransmitter, which is necessary for movement control, which essentially this is like a movement disorder. Mm. One thing you don't do is just start taking iron on your own because you can get this thing called iron overload, which has big heart effects. So you should never start taking iron pills on your own, but you can talk to a doctor. There are a lot of other drugs, too, if you want to talk about those.
Sure, let's hear it.
Basically, any condition that makes you anemic may lower your iron levels enough that you may be getting restless legs. So if you're anemic or you're getting restless legs, talk to your doctor about that. Some SSRIs, which are antidepressants like Prozac, also seem to cause restless legs. So if you're having that problem, you should talk to your doctor about switching perhaps to a different kind of antidepressant that doesn't trigger this. There are a lot of drugs that can help. Basically, this is a dopamine deficiency. So you can increase the dopamine in your brain, and that can help. There are a lot of drugs that can help with that. And most of them are approved for, all of them are actually approved for Parkinson's disease, not restless legs. But doctors use them for restless legs, and they seem to be quite effective.
And if you go to your doctor will know what the heck you're talking about. This neurologist has never even heard of it.
Maybe not. Yeah. The advice that people with restless legs have is, you know, go to your own doctor first. But if you don't get anywhere, see a neurologist or go to a sleep clinic. Those people should know and can be able to help you tease apart what to do.
How unusual, Judy, is it for a syndrome that affects 20 million Americans to be so little known?
Well, I'd like to say it's rare, but I keep stumbling upon these things as a medical writer. I mean, doctors can't know everything. Yeah. And this is the kind of thing that's not going to kill you. So if doctors have to spend their time looking at the fatal stuff, they're going to. But this can really be a life wrecker. I mean, I talked to, I think, 3 or 4 people who have this, and their lives were really destroyed by this. Also, their spouses' lives, because if you're lying there twitching all night, your spouse isn't going to get much sleep either.
RLS, Restless Leg Syndrome. Judy Foreman, thanks very much.
You're very welcome.
Judy Foreman is Here and Now's regular health columnist. To read her latest column, visit our website, here-now.org.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
It's not often that a film director makes the cover of the New York Times Sunday magazine, especially a 32-year-old who was vilified as a teenager for her acting role in a film. But Sofia Coppola, the daughter of Francis Ford, has made the kind of statement the subject of past bad reviews can only dream of. She was her father's choice to replace the ailing Winona Ryder in Godfather 3, and that gave critics negative copy for months. She'd already been vindicated in most minds by her astonishing directorial debut, 2000's The Virgin Suicides. And now film reviewers are searching for new adjectives to praise her latest effort, Lost in Translation. Lost in Translation is a story about cultural differences, fading fame, and karaoke, among other things. Bill Murray stars as a has-been action film actor who's resorted to making his millions making Suntory whiskey ads in Japan. While staying at the Hyatt in Tokyo, he meets Charlotte, a 20-something newlywed waiting around while her self-involved photographer husband travels around Japan for work. Coppola has said that while not autobiographical, parts of the film reflect her travels with her famous director dad and her husband, director Spike Jonze. In this scene, the characters Charlotte and Bob, suffering jet lag, sleep deprivation, and general ennui, meet in the hotel bar.
So, you having a nice time?
Can you keep a secret? I'm trying to organize a prison break. I'm looking for, like, an accomplice. We'd have to first get out of this bar. then the hotel, then the city, and then the country. Are you in or are you out?
I'm in.
Charlotte and Bob embark on a tender and often hilarious relationship. But what exactly is it? A few weeks ago, we had the chance to speak with Sofia Coppola, and that was our first question.
Oh, I wanted to have a kind of a romantic friendship, something that's not a relationship and not just a friendship, those kind of ones in between. Just the idea that in your life you meet different people that maybe you've only spent a couple of days with and they don't become part of your reality or daily life, but they make as much of an impression on you as someone you see all the time. And just about how, and just also when you're traveling, how you can meet people that you wouldn't meet ordinarily in your real life, and how they can remind you of something you forgot about yourself, maybe.
Is there also a reason that they can't? Because the audience doesn't know that. I mean, I didn't know that when I saw that that's what you were trying to do. And the whole time I kept thinking, here's where they're going to go in this direction. Here's where they're going to go in that direction. And they surprised me every time.
That's good. So it's hopefully not boring, because I just wanted to feel like when you're in a hotel in a foreign country and you start noticing the same people, you keep running into them and they have a little bit of a crush because they're both kind of feeling lonely and on their own and they befriend each other. Yeah. But I wanted to make a romantic story that was sweet and not complicated.
And very different. And it's a really overused cliche, but there is a third character here, which is the city of Tokyo. And it's a constant pounding, indecipherable, at least to these two Westerners, Japan. Why that Japan?
I had just spent a bunch of time there when I was in my kind of mid-20s, and it just made such an impression on me. And being there is such a unique experience because it's so foreign and so different than anywhere I've ever been to, and you can't read any signs, and so many visuals and, you know, music playing on every corner. It's really, I found it really exciting and stimulating, but also kind of crazy and overwhelming. So I just spent a bunch of time there, and I have friends there, and I wanted to kind of capture what I loved about it, and also that feeling of being so far away from your regular life.
Yeah, and in many ways, it's what helps push these two characters together.
I think when you're in a heightened situation like that, you know, there's bonding over just the fact that they can speak the same language.
Well, speaking of language, you tread on a third rail here. You know, many people were raised believing that it's impolite to point out that the Japanese reverse their L's and their R's. and that's something that is pointed out repeatedly and hilariously in the film. Let's take a listen first. Here's Bill Murray fending off a Japanese prostitute sent to his room by, I believe, a liquor company that he's doing the advertisements for. Let's listen.
Lick my stockings. Yes, please. Lick them.
What?
Lick them. Hey, lick my stocking.
Hey, lick them. Lick them. What?
Lick them like this. Lick them.
Rip them?
Lip, yes.
You want me to rip your stockings?
Yes, rip my stockings, please.
Rip your stockings?
Yes,
you want
please,
me to rip your stockings?
Please, please.
All right, I'm going to rip your stockings.
Yes.
And you tell Mr.
Yes.
Kazoo, you know,
sure.
We had a blast.
Oh, no, Miss Harris! Oh, my God! Don't touch me! Mr. Bob Harris! Don't touch me! Just lip my stocking! Oh, no!
I laughed so hard at that scene, but that's something, you know, we're not supposed to do.
Right. You know, the thing is that's all, like, from real situations. A friend of mine had a story similar to that scene, and I mean, I remember getting, like, a fax that said, have a nice fright. A lot of people I know, they really switch the R's and L's. Even our call sheets would say, like, interior rimo instead of limo. And our assistant director, who's Japanese, I said, you know, is this offensive at all? And, or, you know, I asked him about it, and he laughed. He goes, no, we really do that. We really do it. Like, he totally thought it was funny and acknowledged it. So I never got the answer of why the R's and L's are switched. But, yeah, there's some poking fun in the movie, but of the Americans as well.
Yeah, well, and let's hope that, you know, some Japanese filmmaker somewhere is making a hilarious film about how, you know, Americans misspeak Japanese.
Oh, yeah.
But it's part of Bill Murray's character's sort of, he really is lost in translation. He can't understand anything he doesn't seem to understand his life.
Yeah, that was the idea, that he's sort of lost in his life, and it's sort of punctuated by being in Japan where you can't figure out how to get around.
He was just wonderful. There was this sense that any minute he might go. and I wonder, how much did he ad-lib?
He's a great improviser. I mean, that was one of the things I knew that he would bring to it that, you know, I know he's a good writer and he's so intelligent and so funny. I was hoping he would, you know, come up with stuff. And like the scene where we're doing the photo shoot for the campaign, we would just throw out names of different people. I would just make things up and whisper in the ear of the photographer, who was a real photographer. And then we would just watch Bill Murray react to it.
Well, in fact, we have that scene. This is a scene in which Bill Murray's character is in this intolerable photo session with, as you said, a real Japanese photographer.
Mm-hmm.
And this whole advertising company entourage. And Bill Murray is posing with the glass of whiskey that he's advertising. And the photographer is going for a certain look.
You are a movie star.
Yes.
Yes, movie, I should be doing movies.
Yeah, but...
And the Lat Pack. Lat Pack. You know Lat Pack?
Rat Pack?
Rat Pack, oh, yes, please. Any more attention, please? What? You're so gentleman, yes?
A ring-a-ding-ding?
Yeah.
Sinatora? You know Sinatora?
Old blue eyes.
Yeah.
It's more of Dino. That's Dino.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay. Joey Bishop, would you like?
Yes. Just change here.
What happened there? Did you suggest Rat Pack?
Yeah, I was just making up random things. And so, yeah, I whispered that to the photographer. And so Bill was really trying to understand what he was saying.
He really
did. He had no idea what the guy was going to say.
As I said, Scarlett Johansson plays opposite Bill Murray. Without giving away the ending,
mm-hmm.
at the very end of the film, Bill Murray whispers something to her. And it's as if you've waited the whole film to hear what he's going to say. And you have him say it to her off mic. What did he say?
People ask me about that. I don't want to make a big deal of that before people see the movie because...
Of course not. You can't
not
tell me what he said.
Yeah. But no, it's between the two of them.
And you.
Yeah.
And it's very cool. And it brings me to, we mentioned you're married to director Spike Jonze, but of course the daughter of Francis Ford. What did your dad think of your film?
He really liked it. When I showed him an early cut, he was one of the first people that saw it, and he was really supportive of it.
How does that work? Would he ever, as he might with other, he works with a lot of filmmakers, mm-hmm. would he ever say to you, that cut there, the way you have that, would it ever work that way, or is it completely hands off?
The script and the shoot, I definitely do on my own, and he's not present for it. But I show him early cuts like other directors and listen to his editorial advice. He's really great at that and can, from all his experience, have ideas for ways that you can change orders of scenes, and then it helps me kind of look at it in that way. So he's given advice, and some of it I take and some of it I don't.
Yeah, well, at the rate you're going, I'm sure he comes to you for advice as well. Sofia Coppola, thank you very much.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Sofia Coppola, writer and director of the new film Lost in Translation. It opens in various cities this weekend.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Join us next time for the news and these stories Here and Now.
On September 11th, Chileans mark the 30th anniversary of the coup that ended the rule of Salvador Allende.
And with overweight kids such a problem, our resident foodies on what belongs inside a school lunchbox.
That's Public Radio's Midday News Magazine, Here and Now.